We're still on our theme of looking at the Dharma through symbols and stories. And we've spent some time looking at symbols or stories about, if you like, the problem, the human condition, where we're at, what's unsatisfactory about where we're at, where normal human beings are at. And we've also spent some time looking at symbols, stories about the goal, Buddha, the Buddha, enlightenment, the enlightened mind, the enlightened being. And now, in the new year, we're going to move on. We're going to move on to symbols, if you like, for... Well, I was going to say symbols of the path. But the path is itself a symbol, so that would be a bit sort of like... But, I mean, the fact of the matter is that if you take, like, I am here, so I am at A, and enlightenment is at B, or my full potential is at B, then I want to... get from A to B, or to grow. I want to move from A to B, or I want to grow from A to B, or I want to suddenly burst out of A and become B, or something. There's somehow that A has to be B. So there's some way that I'm going to move from an unsatisfactory state, an undeveloped state where I am now, to enlightenment, Buddhahood, full potential. So that, you know, we call that the path usually. But the path sort of implies I go, whereas, I don't know, maybe I go whoosh, or I don't know, maybe I sort of vanish behind here and come back in at B. But that's what we're going to look at now. How do we get symbols, stories, if you like, about how we get from A to B, from the problem to the solution? And we'll be... We'll be looking at that for quite a few sessions. So we're going to start these few sessions by looking at, if you like, three stories. Three stories about how we get from A to B. Three models, if you like. Three ways of looking at it. So what I'm going to do this week is introduce these three different models, these three different stories, and then we're going to devote a week to looking at each. So what I'm going to do tonight is just introduce the three... the three stories about the spiritual life, if you like, three models, and then tell a story, which is a real story this time, with characters and a plot, which, as it were, weaves the three together. So, three models and then a story. And in doing this, I have to say I'm very indebted to Subhuti, who's, as far as I know, is the first person I know of who identified these sort of three models, these three different models, three ways of looking at the spiritual life, which seems to me quite important. I think he's done us a real service. So three models, three ways of looking at the spiritual life, not just in Buddhism, but in all, I think in all traditions. I think it sums up, you know, how all traditions look at it. And these three models are the model of self-development, the model of self-surrender, and the model of self-discovery. So I'll just say a little bit about each of those. So first of all, self-development. According to the model of self-development, I work on myself to move from A to B. I do practices which develop qualities that help me to move from A to B, that become more like B and less like A. I work on myself to leave things behind and to develop qualities, and I definitely do it by personal effort. We do it by personal effort, with self-development. So we put ourselves in positive circumstances. We associate with other practitioners. We keep the precepts. We make an effort to keep the precepts. And keeping the precepts develops the habit of being more kindly, more generous, more contented, more honest and straightforward, more aware. So we become more of those qualities, and those are qualities of enlightenment. We move towards those qualities. We make the effort, personal effort, to meditate. We cultivate, intentionally cultivate higher mental states. We intentionally cultivate positive emotions, like positive qualities, like metta, in our meditation. We cultivate wisdom by making the effort to study the Dharma, and by making the effort to reflect on the Dharma, and by feeding truth into our meditation, developing insight. And so we do all those things, and gradually we change. We use the law of karma. We use a sort of law of karma which says that what we act out and what we dwell upon, that we become. So we use the law of karma to become more like we want to be. And this is the sort of, in a way, this is the basic Buddhist model. Gradually, we change. What we act on, what we dwell upon becomes stronger. So by making effort, by choosing, we develop ourselves. We move from A to B, and we do it under our own steam, as it were. We do it under our own steam. So that's self-development. But there's another model. Quite a different one. The model of self-surrender. So in contrast to self-development, we do it ourselves. In self-surrender, we moved from A to B by opening up to something which is beyond us, beyond ourselves, by getting ourselves out of the way. We let something bigger than ourselves act through us. We surrender to it. So in a sense, we become B. We move from A to B by surrendering to B, if you like. We surrender to enlightenment. We surrender to the enlightened mind. Let it act through us. We get ourselves out of the way. We get our old egos out of the way. And we become part of something much bigger than ourselves. So in many traditional forms of Buddhism, there's a sort of element of this in people's relationship to the teacher. So in lots of forms of Tibetan Buddhism, for example, you take on a guru and then you do what they say. You surrender to your guru. You don't say, oh no, I don't agree, I ought to be doing that. You surrender to your guru. In Zen, for example, you have a Zen master and he tells you, do this, you do it. You sit and look at a wall 9 hours a day and you don't argue about it. So there's a sort of element of surrender in the relationship to the teacher. But that's really just an aspect. And so in Tibetan Buddhism, people are encouraged to see the teacher as almost like a representative of the Buddha, as almost an aspect of the Buddha. And surrendering to the teacher is really a way of surrendering to the principle of enlightenment, surrendering to the Buddha, surrendering to the enlightened mind. And that's really what this sort of practice is about. It's about, if you like, surrendering to the enlightened mind. Get our egos out of the way. Surrender. Open up to the enlightened mind. Open up to the force of enlightenment. So, I mean, we in our tradition, we might practice this way by puja, for example, a devotional practice, by chanting mantras, visualizing Buddhas and Bodhisattva figures, so that we connect with something. We connect with some being or some energy which is beyond our usual self. We open up to these energies, these beings. We let them act through us. We even serve them, surrender to them. And in this way, we come to embody them. We come to act them out. So we move from A to B in that way. Instead of sort of going, becoming more like B, A sort of says, I will let B take me over. I will surrender to B. So we just get ourselves out of the way. So it's not such a laborious path. So that's the self-surrender, self-development, self-surrender. And the third of these models is self-discovery. And this approach is based on the idea, if you like, that we all have Buddha nature. We all have what's technically called Tathagatagarbha, the matrix of enlightenment. And this is a very sort of venerable Buddhist tradition, Buddhist idea, rooted in some things that the Buddha himself said. So, you know, very early scriptures of the Buddha, you get the Buddha saying, this mind is luminous, but it is defiled by adventitious defilement. So this mind is luminous, this mind is pure, this mind is bright, But there's all sorts of stuff slapped on it. There's all sorts of stuff, muck. It's like a windscreen. You know, the windscreen's got really mucky. There are flies and mud all over it, and we can't see out of it properly. So this idea that fundamentally we are these radiant, wise beings. Fundamentally, that is the fundamental nature of our mind. If it wasn't for all this stuff slapped on top of it. And in a sense, this is the exact opposite of the Christian doctrine of original sin. Because this one says that in our essence, we are these wise, radiant beings, but our essential nature is covered over. And there's a whole sutra about this called the Tathagatagarbha Sutra, which just goes on and on, actually, with images of this. So it says, oh, it's like, what does it say? It's like an image, it's like a golden statue that's lost in a dung heap. Well, it's not affected, but you can't see it. It's like a treasure buried under a poor man's house. It's like all sorts of things. It just goes on and on in this mode about, well, basically that's what we're like. There's something really radiant about us, but because of all our habits, because of all the patterns we've got into, because of our self-image, that doesn't manifest. It's just deeply obscured. So according to this approach, the spiritual life is not about gradually, it's not about gradually developing the qualities of enlightenment under our own steam. And it's not about opening up to something outside ourselves by self-surrender. It's about finding Buddhahood in our own depths. It's about letting something in us emerge by getting this stuff that's in the way out of the way. So it's like peeling the skins off an onion. Maybe there's a jewel in the middle of the onion. You sort of get rid of the rest, and by the time you get to the centre of the onion, there's something amazing. Getting rid of all the stuff that stops our radiant mind from manifesting. So in this style of practice, one of the most essential things we need to do is to realise that underneath we have this amazing being that we're trying to sort of, as it were, release. This is the real me. It's the real us is underneath this. And we need to start acting accordingly. Just leave the other stuff behind. Act out of what's best in us. So those are three different models. Self-development. Build your Meccano Buddha, I always think this one. More metta, a bit more metta, a bit more mindfulness, and eventually you've got a Buddha. Self-surrender. Get out of the way. Let it act through you. Self-discovery, well, somewhere in here. Throw the junk away, get rid of the junk, and somewhere in here, there's enlightenment. Throw out all your old ideas about yourself. So which is right? They're quite different. I mean, one of them's got to be right, isn't it? Okay, maybe they're all right. They've all... I mean, people do get quite fundamentalist about these, actually. It's funny, you know, it's a funny business. You get people who say, well, of course it's all about self-development. How could it be anything else? It's about praticca-samuppada, it's about conditioned co-production, using karma. That's the only way of looking at it. Anything else is a cop-out. It's just for lazy slobs. Just get in there, work, make effort, grind it out, and go towards enlightenment. That's the only manly way of approaching it, or womanly way of approaching it. Get stuck in and work. And you get people who are, on the other hand, saying, well, it's about self-discovery. So the most extreme proponents of this is we characterise as the followers of California Zen. So, well, relax, man. Chill. You're already a Buddha. Everything you do is all right. Effort just gets in the way. Don't make any effort. Hey, man, driving my work, my murk to the beach is my practice. Or watching the telly, or all the normal things I do. I don't need a formal practice. I don't need formal meditation. That's just formalism. I don't need to make any effort. I don't need to practice the practice the precepts. You know, I mean, that's just slapped on top. Just, I'm enlightened already. So that's the sort of extreme. And in the Buddhist world, I think those are the two most common fundamentalisms. And they can get really fundamentalist about it. It's got to be done this way, or it's got to be... And anyone that does it differently is wrong. And then you get, of course, people outside the Buddhist tradition who think that self-surrender is the only way, especially in the theistic traditions. It's just the only way of doing it. But in fact, we need them all. In fact, we need them all. We might need different ones at different times. Different ones might suit different people. Generally, the one that attracts you most is the one you should avoid. If you like self-discovery, it's self-development for you, my lad. If you like self-development, self-surrender. Just get out of the way. If you like self-surrender, self-development probably. So we might need different ones. Different people might need different ones. We might need different ones at different times, at different stages of the path, to help us with different problems. They've all got their strengths and they've all got their weaknesses. Self-development is the fundamental one in Buddhism. If we're not doing self-development, we're just not going to get anywhere, especially when we start. When we start practicing, we've got to make an effort. We've got to make an effort to get out of some old ruts, get out of some old habits, put ourselves in situations that help. Got to make an effort to get up in the morning to practice meditation, make an effort to practice the precepts, make an effort to see Buddhists rather than going down the pub. Make an effort to go on retreat. We've got to do it. And if we just take one of the others without some of the self-development, well, it's not going to go very far. And especially at first, self-development is the one. But it has got its drawbacks. If we're trying to live the spiritual life without self-development, really we are just being very lazy. But it has got its drawbacks. The drawbacks could be twofold. It could be really successful, or it could fail. If it's really successful, well, how do we get to... I have made myself like this. Look at these people can't keep the precepts. I have got such a good meditator. I keep the precepts. I am an ubermensch. I am an overman. I am a superman. And I made myself this way. And these people can't do it, poor things. So if it's really successful, we can become arrogant. We think, I did this. We become arrogant. It builds up our ego. Far from, if you like, making our ego much more transparent, again, allowing us to transcend our ego, we become more egotistic, more arrogant. That's what might happen if it works really well. And then the other side is it might not work very well. We might get to a certain point, and this is not uncommon, and we hit things in ourselves that we just don't seem to be able to change. This is not uncommon. I mean, I'm trying to act from within the person I am now, and the person I am now cannot will the end of some of the things about the person I am now. I just can't do it. I can't want to stop being certain ways because that's who I am now. I don't know if that makes sense to you. But so we can hit things in ourselves that we just can't change by this method because basically we don't want to. And what happens then is we can get really discouraged. So we get really discouraged and we think, oh, the spiritual life doesn't work. There's no point. I think I'll just go and get a job as a public relations expert or something. Make loads of money. Get myself a Merc. And so we give up on it, basically. People can get to the point where they think, well, I just can't do this. I just can't do it. We set high standards for ourselves. We don't live up to them and we get discouraged. So that's a problem, could be a problem with self-development, two problems with self-development. And then you get self-surrender. Well, this is good because it keeps us humble, doesn't it? I mean, it's not about me doing it. It's about me getting myself out of the way for something bigger than me to act through me. So it keeps us humble. It allows us to call on resources that are way beyond our present ego. If we're opening up to a Buddha or a Bodhisattva that we're contacting through mantras or something, then there can be resources there, qualities there that we're just not normally in touch with. that are beyond us, that we can connect with. So it allows us to call on resources that are beyond our present level of being, that allow us to transcend things in ourselves that we couldn't do by our own unaided efforts. But it's got its drawbacks. The main one, of course, is, well, do it for me. Just laziness, you know. Save me. Laziness. We don't have to make the effort. We rely on the power of something beyond ourselves, so we don't make the effort to practice the precepts, to get up and meditate, etc., etc. And then self-development. I mean, self-development seems to accord with a lot of people's experience. It often seems it's more like discovering, that the spiritual life is more like discovering who we really are than it is like sort of creating a new being. And this is a very optimistic idea. It's a very optimistic that we're fundamentally enlightened. All we've got to do is get the stuff out of the way. We don't get so discouraged. It's very optimistic. We're not going to get as discouraged because we know we already have it in us. And it can make our practice much more immediate to take this approach, because instead of thinking that I've got to develop myself to some time in the future I can behave like an enlightened being, we can say, no, I'll behave like an enlightened being now, because that's who I really am. I'll behave as much like that as I can right now, because that's who I really am. But again, it's got its drawbacks. It can make us very lazy. You know, well, driving my Merc is my practice. We think we don't need to make an effort. We don't think we don't need to do formal practices. And it can make us arrogant, especially if we forget that it's not just me that's got Buddha nature. It's everybody else. Yeah? So it can make us arrogant. And it can make us sort of bring the goal down to our present level. We think it's already in the me I know. So it's just about becoming a little bit better, rather than it's about becoming something which is perhaps unimaginable to us. So all of these three have got strengths, and they've all got problems. We need elements of all of them. We need to emphasize different ones at different times. But we need them all. So there are three models about the spiritual life, three explanations, three stories. And I'd like to tell a story. It's a real story that sort of binds them together in a way that maybe shines a bit of a lamp on all of them. And this is a story from the White Lotus Sutra, which is an early Mahayana sutra going back to India maybe 2,000 years ago. And one of the great things about this sutra is its parables, or its stories. It's got some cracking stories in it. So once upon a time, in India, 2,000 years ago, there was a very, very rich man and his son. And while the son was still a youth, just a boy really, he runs away, or he gets lost, he gets separated from his father irretrievably. He can't find his way home, and he's just a lad. He has no family anymore, he has no trade, he has no way of making a living, he has no support systems whatsoever, so he becomes one of the underclass. One of the lowest of the low. One of the people who live on the edge looking for scraps. And we have to remember this is India. Anyone who's been to India knows what it means to be really poor in India. It's not like scrabbling to be able to pay your colour TV licence. It's like you see people in India, you see people who are filthy. Really, really poor. It's a caste-based society as well. Where the people who are low, the lowest of the low in the social scale, are genuinely looked down upon. So you see people today in India who are filthy, who are dressed in rags because they don't have enough to be able to wash themselves. You see people who look matted, who sleep rough, live in hovels, don't get enough to eat, do the dirtiest work, the filthiest jobs that nobody else would do. And you see that these people are looked down upon. And they themselves have a very low self-image. So this is a sort of underclass that he would be forced into becoming part of. You see that these people do develop a very low image. They don't look people in the face. They sort of cringe as they put out their hands for a handout. And it's obvious that it's not just that other people look down on them, but they've got a very low self-image themselves. They think that about themselves. And maybe because of that low self-esteem, they sort of act in a way that sort of reinforces that. So this is what the son would have become. He would have become one of the lowest of the low, filthy, dirty, half-starved, perhaps diseased, with a very low self-image, dressed in rags, living in a hovel. And the longer he lived like this, the more malnourished he would become, the more unattractive he would become, the more he would think of himself like this, the more he would be ashamed maybe to look people in the eye. The more crude habits he would have picked up. And I mean, this is sounds, I suppose, a little bit politically incorrect, but I mean, I think it's just the fact. I, for example, when I was in my youth, I spent a year being homeless in London and mixing with the lowest of the low, if you like, on that, mixing with people who were really scrabbling. And I picked up all sorts of habits that took me years to get rid of, like swearing really badly, because that's what everybody did. Just really unattractive habit of just really effing and etc. all the time. And it, you know, and it's just because of the sort of company I was keeping, I suppose. So, you know, it's just a reality that we can pick up lots of really unattractive habits. And all this, for this son, forced to be a member of the underclass because he's completely lost his bearings in society. This goes on for decades. He lives like that for decades. He lives like that so long he can't remember anything else. And that this sort of lowly, rather unattractive self becomes second nature to him. That's how he thinks of himself. He thinks of himself in that way. And meanwhile, while the son is going through this, wandering around from place to place like this, living, sinking lower and lower, the father is prospering. So the father, the rich father, lives in a beautiful palace full of jewels and art treasures, set in a wonderful, beautiful grounds, beautiful gardens with peacocks and ornamental birds and ornamental trees and shrubs. He dresses gorgeously. He's got all these, as I say, jewels and artworks, art treasures. He's got troops of servants. He travels with bands of musicians and, you know, dancing people, gorgeously dressed retainers. And when he's at home, he's surrounded by sort of pomp and ceremony. Rich, noble, aristocratic people come to pay court on him and give him presents. So that he lives in a sort of royal court, surrounded by music, beautiful things, highly attractive people, the very richest and the most powerful. He lives as though he was a king. So, the two people, the son and the father. And then, one day, the son's wanderings bring him to the gate of his father's palace. He sort of looks through and he sees this amazing palace. He's filthy and ragged. And he sees his father sort of sitting on a beautiful, you know, under a beautiful palanquin with people paying attention to him. Everything's very beautiful. The son's just looking for any menial work he can get. But he looks in through the gates and he sees his father sitting on his throne under a rich canopy, surrounded by visiting aristocrats. And he just thinks, well, this must be some king. This must be some king. This is no place for me. It's a bit like if me in my peregrinations through homeless London had sort of walked by the gates of Buckingham Palace and seen a Buckingham Palace garden party, I would have just thought, right, let's just get out of here. Just get out of here. So he thinks, this is no place for me. Let's get out of here. But the father sees him, the father recognizes him, and the father says, go and get him, it's my son. You recognize him, and he says to two of his retainers, or three of his retainers, go and get him, get that man. And of course they don't know why He hasn't sort of said, explain. So they just think, right, get that man. And he legs it off down the road. And these guys, well, they basically rugby tackle him, don't they? I mean, they've just been told, get that man. So they bundle on top of him and he's fighting and eventually he ends up unconscious. He's terrified. He thinks he must have done something wrong. So he's terrified. And so the father said, calls him off, calls him off. He realizes this is not going to work. This is no way to get back the relationship with his long lost son. So he says, whoa, leave him. So the son wakes up and he goes on his way. But he finds out where the son lives. So he thinks, I'm going to have to be clever about this. It says he sees, the words of the text are, he sees that his son's disposition is inferior and that his lordly position causes distress to his son. So he sees that even if he told his son, look, you're my son, the son wouldn't believe it and wouldn't be able to act accordingly. He would still feel terribly out of place and uncomfortable. So the father then thinks, I've got to be a bit clever about this. So he sends two men. He sends two men to offer his son a job. And he sends two men who are described in the text as one-eyed, squat, common and unimposing, of doleful and undignified appearance. So he doesn't want to freak his son out. So he says, get these one-eyed, squat, common, unimposing, doleful and undignified servants to go and offer my son a job. So he offers him a job shifting piles of dirt. Well, piles of dirt is actually a euphemism. Piles of dirt is a euphemism. He gets him, it says in the text, shifting piles of dirt from outhouses. So he gets the job that really is given to the lowest of the low, shoveling shit, basically, is what he gets on. So he's moving piles of dung from one place to another. But the father offers him a reward that he can relate to. Double pay. So he gives him double pay for doing this. So the son is really pleased. The son is really pleased. And from that day, he works for his father. He works on his father's estate, doing all these quite difficult jobs, moving piles and piles of dirt. And often it's said the father would observe him through the window of his palace and wonder at how far his son had sort of fallen. He would feel amazed at how very, very, you know, low his son had fallen, and felt very, very sorry for the state that his son was in. He felt huge pity, but he felt he couldn't do anything about it. So he develops another strategy. He develops another strategy for gradually changing his son's self-image. That's what it's basically about. Gradually, refining and strengthening him, gradually increasing his self-esteem, weaning him off his old habits. And the first step in this strategy is to sort of introduce himself to his son on a level that he can relate to. So he pretends to be a foreman on the estate. He pretends to be a foreman on the estate, and he works with his son. And he starts out giving his son a really hard time, saying, do this, do that, faster. Come on, work, man, you know. But gradually, so his son can accept him. He behaves as he was expected to be. So having done that, having sort of got a bit close to the son, working with him as a foreman, he then starts to sort of pretend to take a liking to his son. I like the cut of your jib, young man, you know. I feel almost like a father to you. You stick around here and work for me and I'll see you all right, you know. So he sort of develops this relationship with his son. I'll make sure you get what you need. And then he takes it further than that. He says, you're like a son. You're like a son to me. Treat me as your father. Treat me as your father. And he gives him, at this point, when he says treat me as your father, he gives him a new name. He gives him a new name to go with his new sort of self-image. And he gradually sort of makes the son aware that this whole palace is actually his, and you can treat me as a son. And we're told at this point that although he's been adopted as the son of the rich man, told that he can think of himself as the son of the rich man, he still thinks of himself as lowly. He still thinks of himself as a humble hireling, is what it says in the text. He doesn't really think of himself as the rich man's son. But he gets used to going in and out of the palace. so he doesn't feel quite so out of place, and he starts to dress a bit better. And at this stage, but he still goes to home every night, to his hovel. He still lives in his hovel every night, because that's where he feels most comfy. But then at this stage, the father's strategy, this strategy actually goes on for about 20 years. He takes 20 years moving piles of dirt and then sort of getting into the palace. And then the father ups the stakes a bit and says, look, I'm getting old. I can't live forever. I'm going to need someone to look after my property, my business interests, my palace, my jewels, my artwork. Why don't you become my steward? Become my sort of main manager. And you can look after all my business interests, my treasures, my artwork, my jewels. Once upon a time, the son would never have been able to do this. He just would have regarded this as just completely beyond him. But now he's sort of able to accept. He's able to accept. And he starts dressing in good clothes, living in the palace, hobnobbing with all these very attractive people. He's got a much better self-image. He's got used to the way the aristocrats behave, if you like. So he becomes the rich man's steward. He handles the riches and the artworks. He gets used to beauty. And far from being a humble hireling, he's now in a position of command. But he still doesn't think of any of this as his. It's not his. He doesn't think of it as his. But then, after the son has been steward for quite a long while, the father sees that the son, it says, despises his previous state of mind. He sees that his mind has gradually developed. And then the rich man makes the last move in his strategy. He says he doesn't have long to live, and he calls all the nobles and the aristocrats of the area together, and he makes an announcement: this is my son. This is actually my son. And I'll leave all this to him. And the son says, I'm flabbergasted. With no effort on my part, I've inherited all this. It's only taken him about 40 years, I think. But so he leaves him everything his own. Delightful gardens, the treasures, the business interests, etc., etc. And of course the son is just completely blown away by this. It seems to him completely unexpected. So, how does this relate to these different models? When Sangharakshita talks about this parable, this story, he says, well, who's the father? The father is, if you like, our real self, our Buddha nature. And the son is us. The son is us. And we are cut off from our Buddha nature. We're cut off from our real self. We've lost it. We don't know where it is. And because we've lost it, because we don't know where it is, we've got this quite low self-image. And because we've got this low self-image, we get into all these patterns and all these habits which aren't worthy of us. We develop a sort of crude level of being which is all what we're used to. But it's not really us. It's not really us. But we've really developed them. They've become habits. And so there's an element of this self-discovery in there. What the son needs to do is to realize that he is actually a rich man's son and not a member of the underclass, using this sort of medieval Indian analogies. If he knew that, well, that would help him, but it wouldn't be enough. So there's another parable in the Lotus Sutra where it's a bit different, because somebody gets drunk with their friend. They get drunk with their friend. And I'll go back to the beginning. There's a rich man and a poor man in this parable. And they get drunk. And while they're drunk, the rich man says to his poor friend, look, you never need to be poor again. I'm going to give you a priceless jewel. And I'm going to sew this priceless jewel into your robe. So just don't forget, okay? Priceless jewel, robe. But of course the guy's drunk. And he wakes up the next morning, his rich friend has gone, he's got a terrible headache, lumpy robe, no recollection no recollection, wanders the world being poor and miserable for decades, and then meets up with his rich friend. And his rich friend says, how's it been going then? And he says, well, terrible as usual. Why have you been having this really hard time? What about that priceless jewel that I sewed into your robe? And he says, what priceless jewel? He's still got his robe on. Oh, must be a bit scruffy by now. And he says, look, priceless jewel. And he goes, amazing. I need never have suffered all that. If only I'd known. So that's the sort of pure self-discovery one, isn't it? That's saying, if you only knew that your fundamental nature is Buddha nature, ba-bam, your problems would be over. But the story I've just told is a bit different from that. Yes, it helps to know that he is the rich man's son, but he's developed all sorts of habits and all sorts of self-images and all sorts of ways of being as a result of thinking that he was the lowest of the low, as thinking that he's not a rich man's son. He's developed all these habits, and he's got a lot of work to do to get rid of those habits. He's got a lot of piles of dirt to shift. He's got to sort of shift dirt and then move up to higher sort of levels of effort, of practice, managing the rich man's estate. He's got to gradually become used to certain things. It's not enough for him to know he's a rich man's son. He's got to start acting like a rich man's son, speaking like a rich man's son, and thinking like a rich man's son. And that's going to take practice to sort of erode old habits and develop new ones. So, in a way, it's a much more rounded idea. Yes, there's the element of self-discovery in it, but there's a big element of self-development in it as well, of effort. And then there's also a big element of self-surrender in the relationship between the two figures. The father is Buddhahood, if you like. The fatherhood is enlightenment. And the son gets to where he's going by, in a way, surrendering himself to the father, by doing what the father wants him to do, by opening him, by getting him, his old self out of the way and letting the father sort of govern him, if you like. So that what he does is he just follows along with what the father, who in this case represents Buddhism, represents enlightenment, or the Buddha, he just follows along with the Buddha, with the father. He does what he wants. So it seems to him like he's not making any effort. So that he says at the end, well, I got all this without any effort on my part, because it feels to him as though it's sort of surrender. He's surrendered in a way to his father. So in a way, the story brings the three elements together. And it shows in a way how they're all necessary. It shows how they're all necessary. You couldn't have just one without the other. Self-discovery is not going to be enough without the shifting the muck. Shifting the muck, in a way, is not enough without the self-discovery, without knowing there's something there to discover. And neither is going to work without self-surrender, without a certain amount of opening up to something beyond ourselves, opening up, getting out of the way, opening up to the rich man, the father, in this case. So these are the three models. And we're going to look at these three models in the three coming weeks, I believe. We're going to look at each one in a lot more detail. But so there's the three models and the story.